Welcome to the Montefiore Einstein Health Technology Innovation Podcast Series. Today, we'll be playing a previous recording from an Innovation Biodesign Seminar.
Welcome, everyone. My name, as you've heard, is Baudivine Asmum, and I'm going to be doing a talk on Python, and specifically its use in health technology innovation. So, who am I? My name is, like I said, Baudivine. I've been involved in PARSA's team at the Center for Health Data Innovations for the past 5 years. We have a team of data scientists here working on projects ranging from sepsis intervention using reinforcement learning, predicting and identifying ERDS. We have projects that are about predicting prolonged mechanical ventilation and forecasting ICU capacity. Additionally, I've been using Python for many years and love all things that have to do with Python. And although I learned SAS in college and started my career with R, once I started using Python, I fell in love with the language and with all the possibilities that it gave me. And I never looked back to any other languages. So now I try to be active in the Python community. I contribute to a lot of Python projects, both open source and internally. And I've been going to Python-related conferences, groups, and workshops. So this is going to be a slightly opinionated walkthrough of how I think someone should go about learning Python. And it mirrors the experience that I've had both in the Python and in the data science community. But of course, it's not the end-all be-all way to learn this language. I'm also, you know, I'm not here to tell you to stop using R or SAS or Excel or any other tools that you may be familiar with, but hopefully I can convince some of you to maybe, you know, do a deep dive into the Python language, and hopefully it opens up some new possibilities for you. All right, so as far as the agenda goes, you know, I'll do a very quick introduction to what scientific computing is exactly. I'll go into Python's role in the world of scientific computing. And then we'll go deeper into what your journey into actually learning Python might look like. Once we get through that, I'm going to cover some of the essential libraries in Python that I think are worthwhile to learn, especially if you want to dive deeper into Python and are hoping to use it for research purposes or anything beyond. And then I'll end with going through some projects at Center for Health Data Innovations, where we're using Python and some other common use cases where Python is commonly used in healthcare. As a very quick introduction to scientific computing, and I'm not sure, but I imagine that a lot of people in this room are already familiar with this. But scientific computing, if we look at the Wikipedia definition, is a growing field that uses advanced computing capabilities to understand and solve complex problems. Of course, that is about as vague, you know, as a definition can get, but scientific computing can span many different fields of discipline. It plays an especially large role in machine learning. Machine learning is relevant in nearly all domains. It plays a very large role in finance. Clearly, you know, humans are not capable of dealing with the incredible stream of data and complexity of all the data flowing through our markets and needs mathematical models to process that information. It's very common in biology. There are many examples of its uses in high throughput sequencing, intracellular imaging, and many other use cases in those fields. As far as what we'll talk about today, we'll mostly focus on predictive computational science and also predictive computational science in healthcare. So we'll focus mostly on what I would learn if you wanted to dive deeper into machine learning and doing more data analysis on health data and learning where machine learning can really make an impact in that field. Another thing I'd like to bring up is that this has become possible with the incredible introduction of all of the different high-level programming languages, plus the introduction of the more domain-specific statistical languages. And I just want to do a quick highlight and overview of the vast array of options that are available to us. You know, Python is obviously not the only one. There are many other tools that are available. Quick history of programming and statistical languages and everything in between. I think Lisp is probably a good example of a language that was developed in the late 50s, where people were already using it for artificial intelligence and machine learning. Fun fact, my dad, who's a lifelong programmer, still uses Lisp to this very day for artificial intelligence. MATLAB was developed in the mid-1980s. That's an introduction of one of the more domain-specific statistical languages. Python was actually introduced in 1991. It's much older than people think it is, especially for how dominant it's become in just the last couple of years. R came very shortly after that, same with JavaScript. But languages like Python and R have really been growing to the forefront in the last 10 years. And that perfectly coincides with the rise of data science and all of this computational science. So where does Python fall within the scientific computing landscape? So obviously Python is only a small piece of this entire ecosystem, although I would call it a significant one. My guess is that you're familiar with or have heard of at least the majority of these tools. You know, there's Python, obviously there's R, is very common in a lot of circles. SAS is common in a lot of academic circles. MATLAB, SPSS, Julian, Scala, all of them are important in their own respects. But the way that I would classify these groups of tools is to put them into two buckets, and that is open source and closed source. For those that are not familiar, open source is a philosophy that tools should be free to modify, depending on varying levels of permission from the owner. But what this means for a lot of these scientific languages in the open source community is that users are able to create new tools within the language that simplify or extend the scientific process. And the reason that I bring this up is that I think that having a large user base of contributors is incredibly important for the evolution of the language and the speed with which it can adapt to new discoveries. In the last 10 years, I could name about 10 different deep learning frameworks that have sprung up that are developed either by individuals or groups of individuals or open source teams at companies. Whereas tools like SAS or MATLAB may have one single extension that's maintained by just a single group. And if a new algorithm today is published, you know, the group that publishes it is almost certainly going to implement it in Python and post it for all people to use. And, you know, that kind of thing is just not possible in SAS, MATLAB, or a tool like SPSS. So I definitely do believe that, you know, to stay relevant in today's workforce, you should use a tool, an open source tool like Python. But of course, Python's not the only open source tool. But if you prescribe to the philosophy that being more popular leads to greater developments and a greater influx of new knowledge, then I really strongly believe that you should look no further than Python. Just to get an idea of its growth, this image is a little bit dated. It came out a couple of years ago, but it gives a pretty good idea of how much Python has been growing. And you know, this perfectly coincides with the growth of data science. But in 2012, it took up a fairly small share of users using it, at least on websites like Stack Overflow. But when you get to later years, like 2017, 2018, it jumps to the single most popular language on the website, directly competing with JavaScript and Java. You might be more interested to see how Python directly correlates with a language like R. So if you look at here, you can see some of the other statistical languages on the same spectrum. In this case, you can see Python in the top right. In this example, on the left axis, you can see the growth of the language from going from 2016 to 2017. And on the x-axis, you can see the share of all questions that are being asked on Stack Overflow. And you can see that, for example, R and Python have had a similar rise, but Python has a significantly larger share of all questions that are being asked, with being almost 10%, as opposed to R taking up around 1.5%. I pointed out a couple different languages like MATLAB, which has only been decreasing in popularity, Scala, which is growing at a very slow rate and has a very small user base, and F Sharp, which is, you know, both has almost no users asking about it whatsoever, and is still decreasing. And, you know, questions asked on Stack Overflow is not a perfect representation of how much a language is growing. But there's not many better ways to do it. It's kind of futile to compare languages in terms of popularity. But in my opinion, this is one of the better ways to look at it. So why is Python growing? Is, I think, a good question to ask yourself. The first reason that I would say is that it just has a huge ecosystem of packages. You know, on a nearly daily basis, people are contributing new plugins, modules, and packages that extend the ability of what you can do with Python. Projects such as NumPy, which I'll go into, have been around since the late 90s, but still have huge amounts of people improving and contributing to them every single day. In addition to that, I'd say it's very friendly to use, and it's a very pleasant language to write code in. In contrast to a lot of other languages, I think it's code that can often be written in ways that are often expected by the user. For example, you know, just these images that I printed right here, and Python on the left, if you wanted to write hello world, you would just say print hello world. Whereas in Java, which is, you know, not a totally fair comparison, but just for demonstration purposes, you'd be expected to create a class, then you'd have a main method within there. You'd have to denote that it's a public method. You'd have to denote its return type. And there's just a lot of verbosity that's involved. And, you know, there's benefits and disadvantages to having more verbose code. But from a researcher's perspective, you often just want to accomplish what you're doing and not be boiled down by things like return types and main methods. You want to get to the meat of what you're actually doing. So the fact that it's written in such a clean and user-friendly way makes it very readable. And there's a lot of benefits to being readable. It makes collaboration between different groups significantly easier. The purpose of, you know, the author in this case wouldn't be obscured by the language itself, which makes it much easier to learn and also work with others. And in addition to that, some may say, you know, I can easily read my R code or my MATLAB code. But in Python, there's so much more that you can do beyond just working within the data science realm. Since it's very much a general purpose language, your knowledge will go far beyond just simple data science. You know, you'll be able to build APIs, websites, desktop apps, mobile apps, and everything else. Another thing, you know, that people ask me about why Python is so amazing, when they ask me that, I often point them to this XKCD comic. And I think it's a very nice representation of how easy it is to accomplish certain things in Python, and how it also very much shows how basically everything has already been built. You know, if you want to fly, flying is often just as simple as just importing anti-gravity. And once you've imported anti-gravity, you'll be able to fly. And that's extends to a lot of things in the Python ecosystem. All right, so teaching Python itself is way beyond the scope of this course. It's hard to simply learn Python. So I'm not planning on telling you what an integer is or how you would use pandas to read a CSV file. But what I can do is share my recommendations on learning Python and how I would go about learning it. And like I was saying, it's a general purpose language, which means your knowledge will go beyond simply scientific computation. And this means that with the knowledge of, you know, using Python, you'd be able to build full applications, websites, GUI apps, You can control robots with it and anything else. But that means that the language is not necessarily built to do statistical operations. When Guido van Rossum built it in 1991, he did not intend for this language to be a language used by researchers or data scientists. And in many ways, that's a good thing. But in some ways, it makes it harder to get into. You know, where MATLAB has a built-in way to represent a matrix, in Python, you'll need to import a library, and then you'll need to learn that library, and then you're going to have to use that library to figure out how to represent the matrix. And because of that, there's somewhat of a higher learning curve involved. Fortunately, you know, as far as scientific computation goes, there is an extremely large ecosystem and collection of packages provided by the user base that are there for basically whatever purpose you could imagine. There's packages like Pandas, Dask, and PySpark for working with data frames. There's packages like scikit-image and Pillow for working with images. There's matplotlib, Altair, Seaborn if you wanted to work on visualizations. There's GenSim, Spacey, NLTK for text. And every single domain has a huge amount of packages that are designed just for solving certain questions within those domains. So everyone has a different progression of how you actually go about learning Python. To me, I would group it into a couple different categories. The first category of, one more thing I would want to say about this is that you don't need to become, you can learn Python, but you don't need to become a software engineer. But what you do need is to understand certain fundamentals before you can actually get to analyzing your data. And that's kind of why I'm putting all of these initial steps before you actually get to learning the interesting stuff, because learning the fundamentals is going to, although it's not as fun, having a good grasp on them is going to make learning the packages like Pandas and scikit-learn that are going to do your fancy machine learning and data processing, it's going to make learning that so much easier. And in the end, you're going to waste so much less time figuring out things that are, you know, just constantly outside of the bounds of your knowledge. In addition, you know, you'll learn the building blocks of Python and how everything fits together. And all of the packages that do all of the data science stuff and the research and analysis stuff, they're all built on these same identical building blocks. Like in Python, a data frame, which it's a term some of you might be familiar with, I'll go a little bit more in depth on it in a little bit, but a data frame is just a dictionary of series, and a series is just a NumPy array, and a NumPy array is just a list of values of a specific data type, like integer or string. So no matter how complex the object is, it all eventually boils down to one of the core data structures in Python. And once you have that core understanding of data structures, it's going to make learning all of that other stuff so much easier. But either way, I would say that the very first thing that you should learn is just have an understanding of what the Python interpreter is. Python interpreter is the executable, what you could call it, that actually runs your code. Then you should really understand what a virtual environment is. A virtual environment is a way for Python to have a separate installation for separate projects. And even though you could think of them as just copies of your main Python interpreter, they have their own library of packages. And Python does this to avoid dependency conflicts between different projects. This doesn't sound like it would be something that you should learn in the beginning, but just it would set you up for success. And just having an idea of how virtual environments work is going to make working with different packages much less stress-free and easy. And then just to get started, you'll need to know what the package manager is called pip, and that's the thing that actually installs your packages. So if you need to install an image library, you would use pip, the package manager. Then you'll want to get into understanding those data structures that I was talking about. understanding what an integer is, what a string is, what a float is, you know, some of the core values in Python or the core ways to represent values. And then you want to have a good understanding of the different collections of values in Python, you know, understand what a list is or what a dictionary is or what a tuple is. And even if, you know, if you want to go beyond that, it'll be very useful to understand what a class is, and it's going to make, again, using the library so much easier. Once you have a good understanding of some of the core data structures are in Python, you'll have to actually get into what it means to write code. And by writing code, I mean you need to understand how to use control logic, you know, how to use if statements and else statements, but similarly, how to use loops and iteration. Like, what is an iterable, and how can you control the flow of data by using both control logic and loops and iterations? You know, this is the part that actually makes your code run in a sequential manner and in a way that makes sense and allows you to solve an actual problem. And then I would say, once you've learned all of those things, then I would recommend getting into to the core packages. So the core packages being pandas and numpy and scikit-learn and matplotlib. And I'm gonna give an overview of those packages and the ones that I really think would be valuable to learn. I did wanna give some idea for what some useful resources are for learning. If you know, there's thousands of resources out there online, and there's thousands of really good ones. One thing I would say is that for whatever resource you do choose to use, please use Python 3. There's going to be some really outdated tutorials that are going to tell you to use Python 2. There's even one very popular resource out there. I think it's called Learn Python the Hard Way. And the guy that runs that is notorious for saying, use Python 2, use Python 2. He's wrong, and it's been established that he's wrong. And you know, everyone nowadays uses Python 3. But, you know, if you go through the internet, you're going to find some people that say you should still use Python 2. But for what you're trying to accomplish, you want to use Python 3. I guess some quick background for why it even matters is that when Python moved from Python 2 to 3, they introduced some breaking changes. And a lot of people had, you know, huge companies with millions of lines of code that were dependent on Python 2. And they didn't want to upgrade to Python 3 because it meant upgrading, you know, thousands and thousands of lines of code. And that caused a huge schism in the community. And now the community has gotten over that, but you're still gonna find some bitter people. So as far as learning the basics, you know, there's thousands of online courses out there. Things like Code Academy and online courses like Coursera and Udemy, they're great for learning you know, the base data structures and control flow and logic and those things. There's also lots of free resources out there, like this link that I've put there. I'll definitely be sharing these slides if you're interested. But once you've learned these basics and you've gone through your Code Academy or your Coursera or Udemy courses, that's when I would really get into problem solving. So, you know, even if you just know those base data structures, many people that get to that stage where they have a good understanding of the basics, once they actually try to do something, they're not sure what to do. This is a very common phenomenon. And that's why I suggest going to a website like CodeWars or LeetCode, which is going to present you with problems that you must solve using Python or any other language. And once you've solved it, you'll see how other people solved it and what the best way to solve a problem would be. And this is really going to give you a frame of mind of how to answer certain questions. And I think it's going to be really useful on your learning journey. The other thing that I would say that's going to be massively beneficial is just to pick a project and build it. The only qualifications I would put on that is to choose something that's relevant, and then also choose something that's achievable, but will still push you. When I was just starting to learn Python, I was really into statistics and basketball. So I built a little web app that that showed, you know, a bunch of interesting visualizations for different players in the NBA, and you're able to compare them. And it taught me all about some of these visualization resources. It taught me all about how to build small web apps. It taught me about how do I deploy something. It taught me all of these things I would have never learned otherwise. All right, so once you know the basics, what do you do now? So Python has a huge scientific ecosystem. It all kind of falls under this banner of NumPy and leads to all of these other languages. And so I want to give just an overview of what some of these packages do, and which ones I think are most essential for you to learn to actually get started doing research in Python. The first one I say that should be absolutely essential is NumPy. And NumPy is the single most important scientific library in all of Python and acts as the source to basically all scientific packages. And although it's not absolutely essential that you understand all of NumPy right away, having a good grasp on it will make everything else, just like how knowing the fundamentals in Python makes NumPy easier to understand, understanding NumPy will make all of the other packages significantly easier to understand. The reason for this is that NumPy has created this thing called the ND array, or the n-dimensional array, which means it's a way to represent a matrix with any number of dimensions. And practically every single analytical tool in Python is built on top of this n-dimensional array. This means that it's the foundation of all data structures that you'll learn in Python, like data frames in pandas, the way that images are represented, the way that matrices are represented, the way that embedded text is represented, and everything else. It also, NumPy also offers a comprehensive mathematical function library, and it gives you things like random number generators and linear algebra routines, Fourier transformations, and many other useful tools that are used throughout the scientific ecosystem. Just, I took this off their website, but I think it gives you a good idea of some of the different domains that NumPy is important in. And it's really all of the domains, you know. It's there's packages like in quantum computing called PyQuil and Qtip, and that are all about quantum computing. There's multiple packages built on top of NumPy and signal processing like SciPy and PyWavelets. And there's image processing like OpenCV and scikit-image. There's all kinds of graph tools like NetworkX and iGraph and PyGSP. It's hugely important in astronomy. AstroPy is a really awesome project. Psychology, bioinformatics. Basically, every package that you can imagine that has anything to do with scientific domains in Python is built on top of NumPy. So even though most of these packages are layers of abstraction on top of NumPy, having a good understanding of NumPy is going to make learning all of these a little bit easier. The next one that I would say is probably the most important one to learn is pandas. Pandas is an example of one of those packages that's built on top of NumPy. And pandas essentially replaces everything that you've done with other tools. It replaces SQL, Excel, R, and everything else. And it's really the ultimate Swiss Army knife in Python. And it's going to facilitate most of the needs that you have. It's a mirror and often a direct replacement for SQL in many ways, and is our core way to represent a data frame in Python. For those that are not necessarily familiar with the term data frame, a data frame is a tabular table that represents our data, meaning that each column represents a variable and each row represents a data point, much like what you might be used to in a SQL table. Like I was saying, it mirrors all the computations that are available in SQL-like languages, but it goes above and beyond what's available in terms of analytical functions you can call beyond what's available in SQL. But it gives you all of the same aggregation tools and transformation tools and all of those things. They have utility functions to read data from any source, whether it be a CSV or a Feather or Parquet or HDF5, JSON. You can even read directly from SQL tables or other databases like MongoDB, or if you're just dealing with text data or XML, it's going to facilitate reading in data from any source, and then give you all of the tools to process, transform that data, and make it analysis ready. That's why a lot of the a lot of those scientific tools that I was showing you on the previous slide, a lot of them will expect that you're giving them a pandas a pandas data frame as input. This is just a quick example of a data frame, and those that are familiar with statistical languages or Python or SQL, this is going to be very familiar. As you can see, each column represents a variable and each row represents a subject. The only thing I really want to point out about this is that, again, a data frame is just a dictionary. Each of these columns can just be considered a NumPy array with a specific data type, very similar to how a SQL table can have columns of different data types. But the way that it works to the user is that it acts just as a dictionary, and each element in that dictionary is an array. The next package that I would suggest learning is matplotlib. And matplotlib is the grandfather of all frameworks, all visualization frameworks in Python. It is infinitely customizable, but being infinitely customizable comes at a cost, which is that it's very hard to use. Its API is often unintuitive and very hard to grasp, and there's usually about 100 different ways of doing the exact same thing. Fortunately, there's many alternatives that, like I was saying, are often built directly on top of matplotlib, but have significantly more intuitive APIs. So my personal recommendation is to use a tool like Seaborn or Altair. Seaborn is by far the most popular framework out there and works very closely with matplotlib, and can be combined in many ways. Similarly, even a package like pandas that we were just looking at, the data frame tool has a built-in way to produce matplotlib plots without ever actually having to write matplotlib code. And that's a very common pattern that you'll find in Python whenever there are complex but very flexible packages. You'll see a slew of packages created by the community that act as a layer of abstraction on top of it. The same thing happens, for example, with Keras on top of TensorFlow, Altair on top of Vega. There's countless cases of this happening in Python. Just an example of what some of the plots looks like. Many of you may have probably seen the kinds of matplotlib plots, like you see the one produced on the right here. But what I wanted to point out is the code that was used to produce this plot in the top left, although very powerful, is hard to read, I would say, and not intuitive in the slightest. I don't really need to go into it, but there's many things that are strange about this code that will jump out to you once you start to learn matplotlib. the bottom left, that's an example of code. I didn't use it to create this code on the right, but it just shows you how, for example, other languages have built on top of Matplotlib, but they've made it useful in such a way that you expect it to be. Like you simply specify X and Y and specify what kind of plot you want to see, and it'll build it. This is not something that Matplotlib will do for you, but all of these tools will produce Matplotlib plots for you using more simplified layers of abstraction. One of the last tools that I want to suggest is scikit-learn. Scikit-learn is the all-around machine learning tool that you will no doubt be introduced to once you start to get into machine learning and artificial intelligence. And though it does not provide the kind of computer vision and NLP deep learning tools that you get in more complex packages such as TensorFlow and PyTorch, it still covers a very wide array of what you need when getting into the world of artificial intelligence. And it's essentially used by everyone. It's going to provide you interfaces and models to work with regression models, classification, clustering, dimensionality reduction, and even in beyond to the models for those things, they'll give you tools to do model selection, feature extraction, and all other kinds of things that have to do with machine learning. Beyond it just, you know, being able to do everything, its main strength comes from its very accessible and beautiful API. So once you know how to create one model in scikit-learn, you essentially know how to create all of the models in scikit-learn. Once you know how to create a random forest, the code to creating a gradient boosted tree is essentially identical. The only difference being the name of the tree and the parameters that it takes. And what this means is that the scikit-learn package makes the model creation part of the machine learning process essentially the easy part. But you shouldn't be fooled by its ease of use, because the real challenge in machine learning, especially in healthcare, is just being able to find the right data and being able to represent that data in such a way that you can learn from it. If you put poor data into a model, no matter how good the model is, the results of that model is not going to be very good. I made this example just to show you that you could create a machine learning model and generate predictions in four lines of code. I'm just importing the random forest classifier, and then I'm instantiating the random forest classifier with 100 trees. And in the next line, I'm fitting the model using the Titanic data set that I showed in the pandas example, using the variables class and age. And my Y, which is what I'm going to be predicting, is whether or not the passenger survived. And then that creates the machine learning model. And then all I need to do is predict on the data set, which is our Titanic data set. And we need to know the variables class and age. And once we know those variables, we can produce predictions. And you can see a 1 means that the model predicts that this patient will survive, and a 0 means that the patient will not survive. This looks easy. Of course, in reality, it's not that easy. But just showing you the ease of use of the scikit-learn interface. That was the last Python package I wanted to highlight, but I do want to highlight Jupyter Notebooks. Jupyter Notebooks are practically used by everybody, and I highly recommend you do the same when you embark on your learning journey. And what Jupyter is going to allow you to do is interactive coding. Interactive coding is really useful for data science, as data science is essentially an iterative process. You know, you often try to run a model, take a look at the results, and depending on the results, you want to change a hyperparameter and then maybe run it again. And in addition to that, you really want to be able to view those results immediately and, based on the results that you're viewing, update things that you were doing right before it. So what Jupyter allows you to do is it allows you to run any part of your code, and it allows you to both embed the results and the output along with the code. by doing this, you're creating a document of your entire process. And this made it the de facto standard for sharing Python code and the results. It's very likely you've come across this before, but practically everyone shares code through Jupyter Notebooks. All right. This is just a quick example of what a Jupyter Notebook looks like. All that I really want to show is that you can see that there's a combination here of code. There's a combination of output. There's graphs, and then there's text. I didn't create this notebook, but this is very common in scientific or computational science. And usually the recommended way to share the analysis that you're doing. I'm not going to spend any time on these, but you know, there's so many tools out there for natural language processing. There's GenSim and Spacey. And for things like computer vision, there's OpenCV and all kinds of other tools. Real quick, before we get to the end, I do want to talk about how, sorry, you might hear my Alexa machine giving me reminders. My apologies if you hear Alexa speak. I'm at home. I did want to quickly touch on how some of these things can be used in healthcare. My goal for this presentation was to talk more about Python itself, not necessarily on how it fits into healthcare. So I'm not going to spend too much time on it, but regardless, you know, you should know that knowing Python will lead to lots of relevant applications in this field. There's many potential uses for using Python, especially in managing patient care and hospital flow, with examples ranging from optimizing scheduling of appointments, optimizing staffing and inventory management. There's diagnostics, specifically with dealing with image recognition, primarily in the fields of oncology, pathology. And the vast majority of time, image recognition is done using convolutional neural networks with Python frameworks, such as TensorFlow and OpenCV. And then, of course, machine learning is a very natural fit for prediction of diseases and state of a patient during their encounter during the hospital, especially through the use of time series models like recurrent neural networks or through more traditional shallow machine learning models like logistic regression and random forest. There's many examples of machine learning being able to assign risk for disease or outcomes based on the current state and events that are happening in the hospital. I want to leave some time for questions, so you know I'll try to go through it quick, but hopefully, you know, if you're curious about anything else that I've brought up, please ask me lots of questions. Some of the ways that the categories that I was talking about have manifested themselves at Center for Health Data Innovations is in our data science team or through the following projects. And in reality, I could spend an hour on each of these. Unfortunately, we just don't have time. So I'll quickly cover what each of these are about, and then we can maybe talk about them later. As far as disease prognosis goes, we have multiple projects in that domain. There's a PROOF, which is all about predicting prolonged mechanical ventilation for patients in our hospitals, meaning they're intubated for at least 48 hours, which is an indicator of serious health complications. This is a project that's been going on since 2017 and has been in production since then. We've been generating risk scores for admitted patients on either a 4 or 2 hour basis using their clinical data, such as temperature and respiratory rate and pressors, oxygen devices, and many other factors. Similarly, a project that is acting in a very similar capacity is eCARDS. This is all about both identifying and predicting ARDS from happening. This has been very relevant, especially during this COVID era, where ARDS is a common outcome for COVID patients in the ICU. We've worked with neurosurgery and radiology to use x-rays and radiology reports to identify whether or not notes indicate that a patient is at risk of spinal cord compression. And this is something we want to use to triage patients, as you know, the model is able to review thousands of notes at once. Then we have projects related to sepsis, where we've worked both on using algorithms to improve the identification process of sepsis, but also working on models to improve treatment pathways for septic patients by optimizing the amount of fluids and pressors that should be given to a patient based on their current state. And, you know, lastly, there's so many more projects I want to highlight that we've been working on. I'll quickly highlight, we're working on a lot of forecasting models right now, especially forecasting ICU capacity and the number of COVID patients that are going through the ICU, and also the number of COVID patients that are just being admitted to our various hospitals. Another project we're working on has to do with patient experience and us trying to forecast how many patients are at risk of being absent from their appointments. Lastly, you know, just some final thoughts. Beyond, you know, all of the machine learning projects that I was just talking about, Python is often the driving force behind many of these projects, from building web apps, data ETLs, scripting of our automated processes, and other areas. We use it in many facets on our team. And that's where, in my opinion, I think the strength of Python really lies. It is in the fact that it gives you these super worker abilities. So, no, even if you don't become a software engineer or a data scientist, just the ability for Python to supercharge whatever you were doing, whatever you were already doing, you know, either by making it more efficient or enabling things that you were never able to do before, I think it's going to make it a worthwhile effort no matter what.
Great, great. Thank you so much, Bodhi. Thanks so much for amazing work, for your inspiring presentation, and, you know, for your time. And thanks to everyone for joining. And we'll keep everyone posted in the next seminar. Bodhi, thank you so much, and have a great evening.
Thank you. Thanks, everyone.
Thanks. Take care.